It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. Mondays, Wednesdays, we talk apologetics and theology. Friday, whatever I want. Recently, I was invited onto a popular YouTube channel hosted by Master Samwise, and he wanted me to come on and just talk about Star Wars. So we just talked about Star Wars, our love for it, our thoughts on the future, and yeah, we just had a great session just geeking out on that. He's a great guy, great faithful man. Definitely go and check out his channel. And yeah, I hope you enjoy our conversation that I will play here for you now.
Can you tell me about your personal history with Star Wars, how you first experienced and how, your first experience with it? What made you love Star Wars?
Well, I think like for many people, so I was born in 1985. So I was born after the original trilogy came out in theaters, but many people in my generation, so like the kind of the older millennial generation, were exposed to Star Wars usually on like VHS cassettes. So I remember when I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, there were just two movies that I watched on VHS that really affected me. One was the 1989 Batman. It was like a movie I had just like never seen before, and that got me to really fall in love with superheroes and comic books. And the other was Star Wars, A New Hope, though originally in 1977 it was just called Star Wars. Then later it's called A New Hope. But seeing that was just, as a kid, it's your first time being really inducted into the hero's journey, and you really identify with Luke and the space opera and the lightsaber fights and the wonderful use of miniatures and just everything involved in it. I was just captivated. So I would say it was probably around in the early 90s or so when I first saw that. And then later, you know, saw Empire, Return of the Jedi on VHS before all the special changes were made to them. That's really when my, you know, like many people in my generation, for young men, love of Star Wars began.
No, I absolutely remember watching the original trilogy on VHS. I remember starting The Return of the Jedi for the first time, and it was pretty late at night. It was 9 o'clock or something already. So our parents, we'll watch in a half an hour, maybe an hour. We watched the whole movie. It truly is something special.
Yeah.
So how would you rank the original trilogy?
So there is an objective ranking and a subjective ranking. So subjectively, my favorite film in the original trilogy is A New Hope, the first one. I just have the most emotional attachment to it. And I mean, I just love all the buildup to the trench battle. Just the final trench run is just such a wonderful epic scene and hero's arc of just, you know, everything's built up to this point. And then when the Death Star explodes, it's just the wonderful triumph that's involved in it. And the pacing is excellent. Though what's interesting, and this will come up when we talk about later Star Wars versus earlier Star Wars, it was the lack of Lucas's involvement in some of this. And he had the story ideas and some of the script ideas. But I remember watching a documentary. I think it was called Behind the Magic or Inside the Magic. It was an old DVD documentary from a long time ago that showed the original scripted ending of the trench run. And the pacing was actually just awful. It was terrible. It was really saved in the edit because I think actually like Darth Vader gets shot down, but there's still like another 2 minutes left of action. It was horrible, but it's just got that wonderful pacing and nerve-wracking. It's still like, is he going to make the shot or is he not going to make the shot? And as a kid, I just I just love that. And what's interesting about the trench run there, that was inspired by an earlier film called, I think it was called like Dam Busters. So this is an early World War II film. And you can actually go online to YouTube and you can look at where they match up, I think it was called Dam Busters, where they match up that film with A New Hope, the trench run, and it's almost beat for beat, like, watch out for the towers. So in Dam Busters, it's based on in World War II, when you had to, some of the Allies, when they're bombing these German dams, they had these special bombs where they could skip across the water. So if you went at the dam, just right at the dam, there was anti-aircraft cannons that would shoot you down. If you tried to use a torpedo, like you launch a torpedo in the reservoir to hit the dam and blow it up, there's nets that would stop it. So they had the bombs would skip across the water and then hit the dam. But you had to get the bomb at the exact right target, you know, to hit it as you're flying. The target was about the size of a Womp Rat. No, I'm just kidding. But you see, but the parallel is it's uncanny, yeah. And that's clearly where it's been drawn from. So that's something good if you want to look up to see the parallels there.
I've definitely heard that. I'll have to check that out, check that movie out. But the Dam Busters and the Skipping Bombs, you're talking about that. It was just, I was flashed. I was like, oh yeah, I've heard all that before.
Yes.
And that's super cool.
So it's my number one, followed by Empire, then Return of the Jedi. Though if you had to ask me to put on my film critic's hat, Empire Strikes Back is objectively the best one in the original trilogy. Yeah. Probably followed by New Hope and Return of the Jedi. Return of the Jedi is not awful. It's just, it's not bad. Well, especially until they put Christopher Hayden in at the end in the new editions. But otherwise, that's probably how I would rank them.
Yeah, that's right. I remember seeing that for the first time, and all of a sudden I was like, wait, that's, who's that? Oh, that's Anakin. That's Hayden Christensen. That's weird. I don't like that.
I know.
Return of the Jedi has some very, very good highs and some also just kind of what are we doing here's, you know, a lot of very silly, campy, corny action.
The Ewoks slow it down a little bit. Though as a kid, I was legitimately freaked out by the Caravan of Courage in the Ewok movies. Though that is an interesting side parallel in this, you know, all the different Star Wars films. But yeah, with the Ewoks and everything, it's like, but it's not terrible.
I mean, Luke's redemption, but like Luke's completion of his hero journey, Darth Vader's redemption.
Yeah.
You know, this like their final, their goodbye is, you know, the one moment they spend as father and son is beautiful. It's so well done.
Yeah. And Return of the Jedi comes off a lot more interesting after you watch Revenge of the Sith, comparing the two there to see, because in Revenge of the Sith, obviously, you know, Hayden Christensen's looking at Mace Windu and Emperor Palpatine. And when, you know, he's shocking him, like, what do I do? And he makes the wrong decision there. But then Return of the Jedi, he makes the right decision in a similar circumstance. So that was a good tie-in they did with all of that.
Yeah. I don't think I'd ever thought about that before, but that's a very good point.
Yeah.
So talking about the prequels, I guess we can kind of jump back a little bit. So
yeah,
I know you said in one of your videos that you you are a Jedi Vacantist is the term you use. Now, did you come up with that term or did you hear it somewhere else?
I've heard it other places. I've heard other people mention it. And so it stuck with me there. I thought that because in Catholicism, a Sedi Vacantist is one who thinks there hasn't been a valid pope since then. They all differ. A lot of them will pick 1958. But there's some who think there hasn't been a valid pope since like the 11th century. So a Jedi Vacantist is just someone who thinks like, nah. Now, I mean, I know what really is and isn't canon. I understand and follow that in the extended universe. I'm a Star Wars nerd, but I'm not like a super nerd. I don't have all the tie-in novels and toys and video games. I'm familiar with a lot of them. But my personally, like how I feel about it, I would prefer to not think of those elements as being truly Star Wars. Like they're just, like just the mystique of when in A New Hope, when Obi-Wan says to Luke, or Luke says, you fought with my father in the Clone Wars? Oh, he was a great pilot and a good friend. I don't need any more out of that, really. At least what was given to us in the prequels. The prequels aren't all terrible, but there's a lot that's left to be desired.
Okay, so your personal brand of Jedi Vacantism, because like you said, with Sedi Vacantism, every Sedi Vacantist tends to have a different view of where they draw the line.
I don't reckon after Return of the Jedi, there's only two I'm willing to make an exception on. I'm willing to make an exception for Rogue One being canon, being part of the canonical Star Wars story. I'm okay with that where it fits into everything, and I liked that film, and possibly the 2002 Clone Wars animated series.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that because sure. I saw you mentioned that in your video, and I went and watched the first half of it. I didn't end up watching the second half with my wife, and we looked at each other and went, that is exactly the movie I would make when I was 12 and playing with my Star Wars action figures and Legos. It was just Jedi flipping everywhere, ridiculous force powers, waves upon waves of battle droids and clone troopers clashing together. So I really was just very curious why that would possibly be an exception for you.
It's possible I might be tainted by, when that came out, I was in high school. And so I think I just preferred that as to being a depiction of the Clone Wars versus like what we ended up getting in the films. So I don't know if it would necessarily hit the caliber, but I just remember enjoying it. It's always hard when you try to think of a lot of these things that you enjoy. You have to always be careful with the nostalgia goggles. Then you go back and watch them and you're like, wow, that was actually really bad. So maybe I will go back and see if I was wrong, but I've watched clips of it since then. And I remember there was some scenes, there was one scene where all the clone troopers are fighting droids and there's like this huge weapons ship above them that just starts to attack, and then they all have to turn their weapons and fire at it. I don't know. I just like the bigger spectacle. That maybe the Clone Wars does need that 12-year-old with 100 action figures around him. I don't know. There's just something I liked about it better than similar cacophonies in the prequels. Though I will say with the prequels, sometimes there's so much CGI it's an overload. It's like, what are we doing here? But the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, the battle over Coruscant, is legitimately awesome. Those first about 12 seconds of Obi-Wan and Luke's fighters flying past the Republic ships and engaging the droid ships, that I thought was done very, very well.
I mean, when the prequels, again, CGI overload on occasion, but when they wanted to do action, they generally did it pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, the Duel of the Fates, you know, the Darth Maul and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, that duel is phenomenal. It's lifted a lot by the music, but it's so much fun to watch. It's highly creative. These guys clearly trained very hard at this.
Yeah. The prequels did a good job. They did a good job of bringing about more lightsaber combat and the understanding of it. Like if you go, back to New Hope, for example, and you watch Obi-Wan and Darth Vader fight, it's like watching two old men at the nursing home gently like tap each other. Like, come on, what are you doing here? Yes, they are, but you would still think a Jedi Knight, even in his advanced age, to have a few moves left in him. And especially when you get to Revenge of the Sith, the final fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan, the choreography is just done very well there. I think what's difficult is that, and you see this with Star Wars, like in the original trilogy, especially like A New Hope, when you didn't have a lot of technology at your disposal, you don't have an unlimited budget. You have to be creative and efficient with what you're doing, and that increases the quality. When you have a lot more at your disposal, what you're tempted to do is to throw everything at the screen, and it loses the leanness to it that would make it a great film. That's why there's a wonderful documentary on YouTube about Episode One, The Phantom Menace, where it's the behind the scenes. And I forget what it's called, but it's usually look up documentary Episode One, Phantom Menace on YouTube. You'll find it. And at the end, they show the screening room where Lucas is watching Episode One, and they're watching the end of Episode One. And he realizes he's made a horrible mistake, that there's four different plot lines. You have the Duel of the Fates, you have the battle on Naboo, you have the droid fight where Anakin is flying his starfighter. Everything's all happening at once, so you can't get invested in anything. And he says, you know, I can't take anything out of this. And so it doesn't have as compelling an ending as, say, like episode four had, for which is a similar final battle. One fighter is necessary to win the day. So there you had a lot, but too much is thrown out there.
I don't know if that problem is really endemic throughout the prequels, but it certainly is, I think, in Hollywood today,
yeah,
in general, where it's just too much stuff, too much garbage on screen. I'm assuming you've watched the MCU at least through, you know, the end of through Endgame.
Yeah, I've watched I think almost every MCU film. I saw parts of Thor Dark World, but yeah, like almost all of them.
But I personally really love the Ant-Man movies. I know they're not the best movies. They're not the tightest written.
Actually,
so much fun.
Ant-Man and the Wasp is one of my favorite MCU films. It's easily in the top three for me because
person I've ever heard say that.
Yeah, but you know why? Because it's a smaller stakes story. Mm-hmm. It has smaller stakes that you can be more emotionally invested in. And I'm a big Paul Rudd fan. I don't know. I how can you not like the guy?
He's remarkably charming.
Oh my goodness!
So effortlessly, like just fun to watch on screen.
Yeah, I watch and I feel like that's just him. That's who. What's funny is he's not a great actor because he basically plays Paul Rudd in everything. There's some actors who are like that you enjoy them. But I mean, that's very similar to, like, let's say Ryan Reynolds or Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Though Ryan Reynolds actually does a pretty good job. He's in a movie called, I think it's called Buried, where he's just buried in a casket underground for 90 minutes. It's a survival horror. So he actually, see, he has dramatic chops and he needs it. But a lot of these guys, this is who they are. So Paul Rudd, though, he's always Paul Rudd and he's fun. But I liked Ant-Man and the Wasp because it doesn't overdo it. And it just has a fun story. And it's just, you know, it's fun. And with superhero movies, it's like, look, you have to suspend disbelief a lot. So there is an element of comedy there to, at least with the MCU, to understand you should laugh at kind of the silliness that's going on here. But yeah, so when I, but you said, right, similar with Ant-Man and others, that smaller stakes, but some of these other later MCU projects, everything's thrown at the wall. It's like, let's try to scale it back a little bit here, people.
Well, that was Ant-Man 3, the Quantumania.
I didn't even see it. Can't even do it. Can't do it.
I loved Ant-Man. So my wife and I, once it, you know, came out and streaming, we were like, okay, we'll check it out. First two thirds of the movie, I went, this is kind of mediocre. It's kind of blah. It's not as funny. It doesn't have the same heart. Then the third act happened and it was just this huge cacophony of just CGI enemies and ants and a villain who could do everything until he decided he didn't want to do
he
everything.
Can't, yeah.
Yeah. And just the absolute worst third act I've ever seen in a Marvel
movie. Well, it's a silly thing that they went at, because it's like, what it makes Ant-Man fun is he's small in the regular world. If he's small in the quantum world, that doesn't mean anything.
But anyhow, getting back to
Star Wars.
So you've clearly seen the prequels. Did you bother seeing the Disney sequels? Have you seen the Disney animated Clone Wars series?
I have not seen that one. I saw Force Awakens. I think I went and saw Force Awakens in theaters and was really waiting for that. Then I saw Last Jedi, and that broke me. Broke me, and I couldn't recover. So I have never seen Episode 9. Never seen Episode 9. I don't intend to. Maybe if I'm on a plane, I have nothing better. I know everything that happens, and I've read all the plot summaries. I have no interest. Absolutely no interest at all. Last Jedi just broke me. Rian Johnson killed my childhood. Thanks a lot. But like that, I was like, nah, I'm done with this.
So was it Luke's characterization, his assassination in the eighth movie that really did it in for you?
Well, I just think that the eighth movie is just so high up on itself about subverting expectations. Mm-hmm. It was just so into that rather than just trying to tell a decent story. Like the story itself, it felt more like something out of Star Trek than Star Wars. Like we're being pursued and we're low on fuel and what's the best thing we ought to be doing right now? And then mixed in with silly little side quests and side plots that don't even amount to anything anyways. That I think this is also, you know, the problem with, at least with the original trilogy, Lucas had a vision. He may not have thought everything out entirely. Like, I don't think he had Luke and Leia's relationship perfectly thought out when he did Episode 4. I really don't think so. But he had some general arc and idea of where things were going. It's similar with MCU. Like, MCU Phase 1, 2, and 3 had an arc, and that's what makes Endgame so amazing. It was all going somewhere. Phase 4, 5, and 6, I don't even know where we're going. It doesn't mean anything. And it's similar to 7, 8, and 9. And so I think the problem was, like, J.J. Abrams is really great at starting franchises. He's just not great at finishing them. Like, so J.J. Abrams was interesting that when he was a kid, he was taken to a magic shop once, and there was a mystery box covered in question marks, and you didn't know what was in it. So he bought it, he took it home, but he never opened it because it was more exciting for him to have the box and not know what was in it than to open it. And that mystery box is something that has been in a lot of his work, most notably Lost. And so that's why Lost started off with a bang. It's like, this is an amazing series. What's going on? So much mystery and everything here. But Abrams doesn't know how to, like, finish it all off, say, where does the mystery go to? And with Force Awakens, we see that, like, you know, who is Rey? What is her relationship? What, you know, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm. Who is Snoke? Yeah.
Yeah, and Snoke, and what is all of this? And there was promise there. There was promise with Kylo Ren being tempted to the light. Like, I thought the idea of being tempted to the light, whereas throughout the rest of the previous Star Wars is all about being tempted to the dark side, I thought that was a really interesting story element. But just, yeah, well, where Luke's character, Luke has just become this just absolutely jaded individual. It did not sit well with me. And then just everything else, Admiral Holdo, being like acting just completely absurd. Poe being treated as a villain when he's doing the most rational thing. none of it just made sense to me. Whereas the original trilogy, and even in the prequels, there are things you might laugh at a little or find cringy, but at least made sense.
Well, the prequels had a vision. You talked about that with George Lucas. He had a vision for the OT. He very clearly has a vision for the prequels.
Yes.
Right? And he knew where it was going. I mean, obviously, he knew where it was going because he knew where A New Hope started.
Yeah.
But he just didn't execute it super well, and in part, I think, because, like you said, he was too involved. I mean, he wrote the script, and they should not have let him write the script. He has no business doing that, clearly.
Yeah. No, he's... That's the difficulty there. And then, so I've heard everything then with episode 9, then it just becomes, well, let's throw everything back at the screen that people liked in the past and try to salvage it. And what's hard is the original trilogy was in a time when people wanted to really be storytellers. And it wasn't, you weren't as concerned. And this is a problem with the industry, how it's changed over the years. In order to make films now, it's really not about making films. It's about making a bottom line back. Oftentimes through overseas international releases. And this is a problem in all across all media in Hollywood. So, for example, I love going to the comedies. When I was growing up as a millennial from like 2004 to like 2012, it was like a golden age of comedies. You know, you had Tropic Thunder, you had Anchorman, you had a lot of Judd Apatow comedies, a lot of like great comedic films, Napoleon Dynamite in early 2000s. And you had a lot of that, and these films could survive because even if they didn't do great in the theaters, or they did okay in theaters, they could make up money back on DVD sales. But now in the age of streaming, in the age of where we're at now, and with the inflated costs for filmmaking, you have to make something that can appeal to a foreign market, and superhero movies or things blow up was kind of the go-to for a while, where you don't even have to worry about story. As long as, you know, an international audience can like what they see on screen. And I think that infected a lot of Star Wars films. If there's a lot of spectacle and things blowing up, you know, it's like in Force Awakens, well, the Death Star was cool, but what if we had something that could blow up a whole system? It's like, okay, that doesn't actually make me feel. The Death Star approaching Alderaan in episode 4 and Tarkin building it up there, that's way more anxiety producing for me than just these nameless planets getting. I don't know what these planets are. I don't care. So I think that's kind of the problems we've seen.
Yeah, there's, I mean, this is a large problem in filmmaking in general now, where it relies on familiarity and member berries and key jangling as opposed to...
Member Chewbacca?
Yeah.
I remember Chewbacca.
And it's just, it's so difficult, because when you're creating something in the Star Wars universe, you want to have those familiar elements. People are going to get... I'm mad if you don't have some familiar elements. If the prequels didn't have any lightsabers in them, that would have been weird.
Yeah.
But it seemed like, especially with episode 9, it's like every Star Destroyer is now a Death Star.
It's like, what is happening here?
I don't care.
And here's the thing. You don't have to, you can have a few of those elements. You can even take the older property and have some of the member berries and still make something great. Top Gun Maverick is a great example of that. It's a really good film. And you could see that film even if you never saw the original Top Gun. But there's enough there, the threads going back to the original Top Gun, be like, oh, that's really cool, but it's building on itself a new story. Though, ironically enough, what makes Top Gun Maverick so exciting is it's basically Star Wars Episode 4. It's basically A New Hope. A New Hope is we've got to hit this unique target, and only the best pilot's going to be able to do it. It'll be a miracle if we can pull it off. That's the climax of Top Gun Maverick. It's basically the same. It's a trench run. It's the same sequence. But it doesn't just end with that like A New Hope. It does do something good later on with Tom Cruise and Miles Teller, who I have been told I look a little bit like Miles Teller. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's good. Sometimes I get Miles Teller. Other times I get Ray Romano. I'm less excited to hear Ray Romano than Miles Teller.
How funny. I thought what I was going to say. With beyond the movies and I guess the shows, did you ever dive into like any of the Star Wars novels or video games? What's been your experience with those?
I mean, I'm familiar with some of them. I would go over to people's houses sometimes and watch them play. I mean, I remember Rogue Squadron a little and Knights of the Old Republic, but I didn't play them very much. I think the only Star Wars games I played a lot was I played Star Wars for the Super Nintendo, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. Those games are hard. Like, you really got to put in the grind for the Super Nintendo Star Wars games. There's in Star Wars, in the original Star Wars Super Nintendo game, Like, I remember just on the Sandcrawler one, if you just took one wrong step, you lost all your weapons, you were dead, and you're back to square one. It was the worst. But it was very satisfying to do those. And the Empire game had a really good fight with Darth Vader at the end of it. But otherwise, the other one that I played, the one I played all the time, though, probably high school, college, was Star Wars Battlefront for PlayStation. And that was just like, you really got to feel like a Jedi or a Sith, shocking people, force choking them. But the books, I did not read the books. I'm familiar with some of the plot lines in some of the books. I think there was one extended novel where, like, there is a, it's like Luke or some relative of Luke, somebody hijacks a fighter, and it's a single fighter that has like the power to destroy a planet. I don't know if I'm misremembering this, but I do think there was a novel about that, which is an interesting way to go about it. That's an area where I did not have enough free time to get into a lot of the extended lore and the novels or things like that.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, I had to ask because on the shelf behind me, you can see two clone trooper helmets.
Oh, nice.
Those were Christmas gifts, I think consecutive years from my wife, who is as big a Star Wars nerd as I am.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And, so the helmets belong to two clone commandos, or part of Delta Squad, which is a video game released back in 2005, I think, for the original Xbox.
Oh, okay.
That one video game is the reason why I can forgive practically all the errors the prequels made, because they gave me this game. So it's basically this story about a team of four clone commandos who go on various, essentially infiltration missions, as you know, during the Clone Wars. It's a very short game. I think it takes probably 6 to 8 hours to play through. And it's one of the best stories that Star Wars has ever told.
Really?
Because it takes this element of war that, you know, we see war happen in Star Wars. We see, you know, death constantly. We see, you know, lots and lots of fights and blaster battles. But you never really explore this personal element of the troops on the ground. Clone Wars does, the animated series for sure later.
Now, is this Star Wars, is it Republic Commando?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. This came out in 2000. I'm looking it up right now because I enjoy, so I have, when the kids go to bed, I go into some of my older Xbox. I don't play any of the newer games, really. I'm not really into that as much. I still will go online, and I have the Halo Master Chief Collection, and I was really that was my favorite when I was a teen and early college, going online to play Halo. I was like, oh, this is the best ever. And then I heard that the servers were shut down a few years ago. I'm like, oh, that'll be sad if I never get to do that. But there's still a Halo for the Master Chief Collection. Yep. But so I think on my Xbox, I'm going to go check this out. I think I could still play Republic Commando on it. So
it's still available.
Yeah, I will. Go ahead.
I will not spoil anything. That, okay. But it is a remarkable story about like the brotherhood forged in war.
Yeah.
Right. And these clone troopers have grown up for, I guess, you know, only 10 years. They're 20, but they're 10. But they've spent their entire lives together.
Yeah.
And like they're, you know, they've gone through the thick and the thin of it, and they have this incredible bond and rapport. Their voices are all different, so you can actually distinguish between them, which is not really canonically accurate. Yeah. I have an explanation for it, but that's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
They differentiate, but they each have their own role. They have their own, you know, uniform and color and personality. And just, I don't know, it's such a masterpiece of storytelling through very limited means, because they don't have like cut scenes for the most part. They have very, very short ones.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have these wonderful, like you see nowadays, which I do love in certain titles, of these beautiful, you know, Unreal Engine 5 or whatever, like animated cutscenes where people, you know, you see every pore in their skin.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, through the voice acting, through them chirping at each other as they enter combat and making fun of each other, reciting the rules of the commandos. It's this wonderful story, and you just really understand, okay, like this is kind of the beauty that comes out of war, is this bond. My favorite show ever is Band of Brothers.
And I was about to say, this sounds a lot like Band of Brothers.
Yep. It thematically very similar. And so, yeah, that's why I love it. That's why those helmets, you know, will be on that shelf as long as I can keep them there. I will forgive the prequels for every, you know, wooden line spoken by the characters because they gave me this game.
I hate sand. Gets everywhere. But that's great.
Breaking my heart.
Oh my gosh, so awful. But yeah, so I'm going to check that out. That's interesting because that came out in 2005. And I was saying, so I like playing Star Wars Battlefront 2 on...
Which overshadowed it big time.
I think that's, yeah, because I didn't hear about this. But, I mean, Battlefront 2 is huge. So that was on the PlayStation 2. It was interesting because there's another one that came out. A lot, our younger listeners might be like, are you talking about the 2017 game? No. I'm talking about 2005, PlayStation 2. Me and my friends, we get together. The most fun would be there was a level you could play where it was heroes versus villains. Mm-hmm. And it was on Mos Eisley. And it's just all... Because when you would play the game normally with the droids or the clone troopers, you could lead them with being a Jedi or a Sith.
If you did certain things that earned you the hero.
Yeah, they would earn you the hero, and you could play for them for a limited time to just wreck people out on the battlefield. So the heroes versus villain level is you just had them all in Mos Eisley, and it was hilarious and so fun to play with people. But you're right. I think that probably – I was so distracted by that, I didn't see Republic Commando.
Yeah, I mean, that's what – because that would have happened – that would have come out when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And so that was one of the first games that I – one of the first Star Wars games that I ended up picking and playing after Lego Star Wars. Lego Star Wars would have been the first one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Phenomenal game.
So now we're seeing the difference here. You are, let's see.
I was born in 93.
90. So, okay. So you are right. You are a baby millennial. You're a baby millennial. And the question I always ask is now, so in 93, you would have remembered 9/11.
Yes.
So you're still a millennial. That's always my question. Yeah. If you remember 9/11, you're a millennial. If you don't remember 9/11, you're Gen Z.
Yeah, my wife is born 2 years after me. She also remembers 9/11, so she's right on the cusp as well.
Barely make it.
But yeah, so that was one of my first experiences with Star Wars video games, and like you said, I think I had like a Star Wars collection of like four games that included Battlefront and Rebel Commando and Empire at War maybe, which is an real time strategy game.
Yeah.
And I kind of ignored Rebel Commando. I was playing Battlefront. You know, go and be clone troopers.
Oh, so fun.
Be Obi-Wan and Darth Maul. It's a great time. And then I picked up Republic Commando, and I don't want to say it changed my life, but it kind of changed my life. It gives you this appreciation for how to tell stories when you're severely limited on what you can technically do.
I think that video games can do that. Like for example, I remember when I was 13 years old. Yeah, so I would have been 13 years old. Metal Gear Solid came out on the PlayStation 1, and that was my first encounter with a video game. Like before that, when I played video games, it was Mario, it was Star Fox, it was driving games. This is my first encounter with a game that is, I am playing now mature adult thematic elements within a game. You say about cutscenes, it's interesting that Republic Commando is lighter on them. Hideo Kojima and Metal Gear Solid, it's like, wow, I'm watching a 5-hour movie here while I'm trying to play. But as you're a 13-year-old kid, you're in the eighth grade, it's like, whoa, this is like, over my head, but I like it. Like that was the best best entertainment for children. Like, but that's why I think a lot of entertainment today for kids is awful. The ones that were really good back in the day, like Batman the Animated Series, was it was written in kind of a way, this is a little bit over my head as a kid, but I like it. And I think that's a good way to go with a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, the premier example of that, and we're veering off track, but that's okay, is Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yes.
Which, I mean, that is one of the best shows ever made.
Yeah.
And it is, it's written for kids, to be digestible for kids is what I like to say. But, our oldest is 6 years old. And we're like, this is appropriate for him, but we're not going to let him watch it yet because he wouldn't quite get it. We wanted to get it at least a little bit more.
I'll tell you, it was funny. My kids are starting to get involved with the prequels. And I was out of town. Like, we watched episode 1 and 2 together. And although I have my own, I think I previously showed them episode 4 and 5. I have my own thoughts about the correct order to watch them in. But I was out of town. I think they watched episode 2. They say, can we watch Star Wars? And mom's like, yeah, sure. And she puts on Revenge of the Sith. And I'm like, Laura, that's a pretty intense one for like our youngest actually to see that. She's like, I thought it was okay. It was Star Wars. I'm like, not that one. That's the, of all six original villains, that's probably the most intense one.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
With the prequels being mediocre, generally accepted as pretty mediocre, I know there are people who love them out there, and I don't mean to insult my prequel-loving fans. I love you guys. I wish I liked the movies as much as you did. I just don't. But, Trent, what do you think, or why do you think Star Wars has had this incredibly long-lasting cultural impact, despite the fact that like six of the nine mainline movies are kind of bad.
Well, I do think that the original trilogy, well, I don't know, like it's longstanding impact. I wonder with the youngest people like Gen Alpha, like do they even care about Star Wars since they have so many other things that they're attracted to? I think that, I guess if I had to summarize it, it would be Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces. So he was a scholar who talked about how there's a particular hero's archetype that in all great stories throughout history tends to follow. And if you write a story that follows it, people find it to be very pleasing. It's just, if I describe it, say there is a humble man from humble beginnings, is given a call to adventure through a magical artifact, refuses at first, recognizes the gravity of refusing, joins the call, pursues adventure, hits a setback, learns from the failure, then goes to conquer the hero at the villain at the end, returns to the village, a changed person, yada, yada, yada. There's like 8 or 10 points. But if you map out, for example, Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter, the main character of the Lego movie, if you map out a lot of these classic films, it's like, oh, it's all they hit beat, beat, beat. It's very, very similar. And it's just a good people just there's like an intuitive human reaction. They like a story like that. So I think that it taps into that desire for that hero's journey, and it brings elements that people just for hundreds of years have liked in stories. Like even the idea of swashbuckling. We talk about pirate adventures. Like just the decision, I don't know why, but the decision to make one of the primary weapons in Star Wars a sword rather than all just guns, it brings you back to a more elegant age, as Obi-Wan would say. There's a timeless quality to it, a timeless sense of adventure that all people want to be connected to. So the newer films and TV series fail when they can't adhere to the timeless aesthetic. So, for example, Episode 4 may not be my favorite film. It may be one that people would have hated, actually, if one fact of history was different, that the original Star Wars, they wanted the musical score to be disco. Because think about it, it came out in 1977, right? That would have made sense at the time, like disco. This is so fun. But no one would watch. You would laugh at it today because it would be a 70s movie. But the John Williams score gives it a timeless appeal to it. So I think that those timeless elements of heroism that are in some of the elements to it, that's what makes it so enduring even to today.
Do you think that just the inventiveness of the world building played a large role as well?
I mean, yes.
Star Wars came out and we had other, space age stuff. Star Trek existed. Dune existed. I don't know. I kind of try to puzzle this in my head. What really made Star Wars' inventiveness stand out among the others?
I think the world building is, if you look at properties that are longstanding, they have lovingly crafted worlds. So look at Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, for example. Star Trek is still a property that can exist for a long time because the Federation and all the distinct alien life forms within it, that's a thoughtfully crafted worldview from Gene Roddenberry. But there was a lot of science, like when Star Wars was such a big hit, everyone was like, we got to get on this right now. So like Disney put out The Black Hole in 1979. And that was a huge flop. I mentioned now, hardly anybody here remembers that film.
Never heard of it.
Exactly. There's all kinds of space and science fiction films from that time period, but you don't have that wonderful, magical world building all put together that's enticing to people. I think if you can build a world that is not too bare bones, it's just an excuse for action, versus one that's so overly complicated nobody can make heads or tails of it, it's finding the balance between the two. I think that it lends itself to longevity.
Well, I think what Star Wars did well there was that Lucas left a lot of room for expansion, right? His Star Wars world, and this was very purposeful, I think, on his part, where it was not just, okay, this is the system, these are the planets, these are the peoples, these are the different alien races, these are the technologies. Those all existed, but they weren't limited to that.
It's flexible, race. Yeah.
Yeah, every new movie explored something new, and that was his comment on The Force Awakens. He's like, there was nothing new here. We've seen
what's hard. I did enjoy it because it played it safe, but one of my criticisms was it was just a reskin of A New Hope. So it was And I guess what's hard is they're like, well, you know, we tried all these risks in Last Jedi and we didn't like it. It's like, no, you don't have to do that.
Do it better.
Yeah, you can, like, you look at Rogue One, for example. It tells just a unique, there's a bare-bone elements there, you know. There's one line in A New Hope, like, many Bothan spies died to give us this information. That's it. And you fill in the gap with all kinds of other interesting stuff, and it all ties through the threads. So it's like, connect the major elements, but have fun with the mystique in the middle. Though I think part of that was intentional. I think other parts of it were just unintentional. Lucas didn't totally think it through, which is a kind of happy accident, I think, for Star Wars. That there's a meme online where it shows like a Jenga tower, and it's like all the things Star Wars that we love, and it's balanced on one tiny Jenga piece at the bottom, and it says something George Lucas didn't fully think through in 1977, like holding all of it up.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
So you talk about Rogue One. I assume you've probably not seen Andor as that's come out.
I have not. My free time for watching things has been severely diminished and is more consumed now with watching things from the past that I know are good. Like, I'm introducing my wife to the series Freaks and Geeks, for example. I just bought it on DVD, which is really underrated. It was canceled after one season, but it's just an awesome comedy from 1999. But yeah, so it's hard for me to get into things unless I get a quality assurance.
That was my attitude, because I started my YouTube channel after my wife and I watched the first episode of the Obi-Wan Kenobi show, which came out in 2022, and yeah. I went, that was bad. She didn't watch anymore. I watched the rest of it and started making videos about it.
Okay.
Because it was so bad, it annoyed me into making videos about it. In particular, one scene where this Sith Inquisitor is, which are a whole other can of worms in and of themselves, but is interrogating a bunch of people. And I went, I've seen this scene before, and I've seen it done better. And that was in the game Jedi Fallen Order, which came out a few years earlier. And so I made a video comparing the two, and off the channel went. Anyhow, So I didn't watch Andor when it came out, because I went, I'm kind of over it. I don't know if it's going to be good. I'm not really going to waste my time. And then I kept hearing good things, so I tuned in and watched it. And it's very different for most Star Wars, and that definitely strikes a nerve with people. But it is undeniably very well written.
Okay.
I thoroughly enjoy it. It's not without its issues, thematically, philosophically. It has some. It's got a lot that it explores and kind of leaves open. It's very much not preachy, which is a breath of fresh air, even if you can tell the creators are not philosophically aligned with you.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a fascinating story. It's leading up to Rogue One, essentially. It's like 5 years. The 5 years leading up to Rogue One.
Okay.
So it's remarkable that they pulled off an actually compelling story, considering, you know, the main character is Cassian Andor, and we already knew we've seen him die.
Right.
You know, it's quite good if you ever happen to get around to
I will give it a, I might give that a, might give that a shot then. I think it's hard because the Star Wars TV series, I was really turned off. I remember the Mandalorian hype, and then when I saw like Jack Black was in one of the seasons, one of the episodes, and it just, yeah, I'm like, this is all falling. You broke my trust, Disney. Doesn't take a lot to break it. It takes a lot to earn it back.
So on that note, is there like any hope still within you for Star Wars? You know, could anything make you, you know, well, reject Jedi Vacantism, at least, you know, accept the new canon. What would happen to kind of bring you back to Star Wars?
I don't know. I think what would have to happen would just be if I got really good word of mouth that there was a Star Wars property that came out, or a film or TV series that was great. If I heard, this is awesome, even if you don't know a lot about Star Wars. It's like, oh, that would really perk my interest of someone trying something new. So, for example, like with the MCU, like I tried to give them the benefit of the doubt with Phase 4, but after Doctor Strange 2, I just ended up kind of checking out. I'm like, I don't like where all of this is going. But in Phase 4, there was one film, and it was released directly on Disney Plus, and it's called Werewolf by Night, based on the comic series. And it was filmed in black and white. It had a horror element to it. And I remember just watching it. It was around Halloween, I think. And the opening has the opening Marvel logo, but then it becomes all gothic and scary with the music. And there's claw marks going through the Marvel logo. And I'm like, all right, this is different. It's Marvel, but it's different. And I like that. follows the Marvel adventure idea of powers and adventure. So it's not like wildly different, but it's trying something really new. So I'm not sure if it was something that, you know, it's just that fine line of retaining the mythos. There's a spectrum. If it's a full on carbon copy, that's boring. If it totally subverts your expectations with a bunch of liberal looniness, that's nauseating. So it's that fine line, if I could see between where it has the threads of it, but creates something new from that, that can stand on its own while neatly tying in other places, then I might be brought in.
Yeah, I would say that for Star Wars to really, you know, come back, people like to say Star Wars is dead, and I disagree with that statement because Star Wars is, no, not eternal, but just living on for people, just because people remember what they loved about the good ones.
Yeah.
But yeah, as an existing franchise, it's certainly struggling, to say the least. And I think for it to really come back, to really ignite a flame, it needs to have something that it needs to make a new movie. Disney Plus shows are great and all, I guess, if they're good. But
yeah,
like, it needs to have a mainline film that is really well done, is well written, is well cast, is, you know, does not rely on, you know, CGI and splashy colors on the screen.
Yeah.
That retains the heart of Star Wars and doesn't wear the skin suit of another movie.
And I think the problem is why I was turned off from the episode 7, 8, and 9 was the biggest problem here is it's the whole, like, the girl boss mentality. And it's not even just about, like, men or women or things like that. Watching the original trilogy, it's really the characters are gripping with their positives and their negatives. That Han Solo's brashness can be a positive and a negative. Luke's naivety, and he has a good heart, but he gets himself into trouble real easily. Like when he goes in the Mos Eisley Cantina, for example, or when he's, you know, you can see a growth there in characters, and so that's just really gripping to be able to see. So I like just comparing Luke in the original trilogy to Rey, it's a night and day difference. It's so boring. That's the thing I didn't like about it. It's like, why should I care about this protagonist, Rey? She's perfect in every way. She has no flaws. It's just like, even for example, like you go to the DCEU, the DC superhero universe, and you look at Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is actually a pretty decent film. What's hilarious there is like Gal Gadot is this superpowered woman, but she's kind of naive about the outside world, and there's an endearing quality that provides a weakness for her that she doesn't fully understand. What's funny is like, wow, I thought like, oh, Gal Gadot's a really good actress here. Then I come to see, oh no, she's actually a bad actress. This is just one role where her not great acting plays well in a fish out of water story. when you go and look online, like, oh, that was just a coincidence that it came off well there. But yeah, comparing like Luke and Rey, that to me is the paradigmatic example there of just like, oh my, like, it's just, that's, you'd want a, if you're going to do a new movie, you would want a hero that, and it can be a woman. That'd be great. There are great films with female protagonists who are not insufferable girl bosses and are tough. Like, some people are like, well, you just don't like it because you're a misogynist. That's not true. Like, Ripley in Aliens is a great female protagonist. Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2 is a girl boss, but she's not insufferable. Like, she can play a tough female character without falling into a lot of these modern feminist tropes. And there's lots and lots of examples like that. But the problem here is if you're going to have a good Star Wars film, it'd have to be entrusted to an artist and not be beholden to the whims of a company.
Yeah. I mean, selling to Disney was not great for the franchise.
Well, Lucas said, I felt like I sold my kids to slave traders. And I'm like, that's a little dramatic, George, and insensitive to people, but I see where you're coming from.
But Ahsoka Tano from the Clone Wars series. Does she show up in the one from 2003? I forget if that's where she gets introduced or if that's the Clone Wars movie.
Possibly. I can't remember so long
she's,
ago.
She's Anakin's Padawan. And she's a great example of how to write a female character, because she is young and inexperienced. So she makes a lot of mistakes, which she tries to make up for by being assertive and makes more mistakes. And then she grows, right? She develops.
Exactly.
She has kind of this tragic arc, but like kind of a triumphant homecoming almost, but still in a tragic way. She's a great character. And I think that we're this like flat, almost like emotionless, flawless, personless, right? Like girl boss comes from is, I honestly think it comes from men who are too afraid to write women with flaws.
Yeah, they're worried they're going to be pilloried for that. They're going to be accused of purposely writing weak women, or women who feel like they have to vindicate women and just have the woman who can, you know, who can do anything. They're writing a strong female character under the frame, and strong for them is a male archetype, where a woman demonstrates strength by acting like a very stoic man. Whereas, like, you go to the original Wonder Woman, she, like, is this strong woman who she subverts the plot by, you know, Trevor, the guy that she rescues, who introduces her to the outside world, she saves him from the bad guys, you know, flips the script, and she demonstrates her strength and power. She's much more stronger than him. And yet when she sees a baby, she fawns over the baby. Her femininity comes out. She's not, whereas a lot of these, like, when you look at the women in Star Wars, they hardly show any femininity. They if you just describe them to someone, a person would think that they were a man. Like, look at Holdo, for example, even how Rey acts, if you didn't know anymore. But strength or authentic femininity is a good thing that provides a different perspective of the masculine perspective that can be interesting to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. My most viewed video of all time is titled "Audiences Hate Bad Writing, Not Strong Women."
Right.
It really struck a chord with people because we keep seeing this resurgence of, you know, one after the other, and they still do it. It's still going on, and I'm waiting for the dam to break finally. There is just like I just want characters again. There's a game I'm playing now. It's called Clair Obscur Expedition 33, which is a whole heck of a mouthful.
Yeah.
And it's I get to play video games now because I make videos about them for the channel, which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
The most of the main cast is women, and then I'm watching them, you know, and these, you know, again, beautifully detailed cutscenes that they can do now, watching them have authentic conversations about like their lives and their experiences and the tragedies they've suffered. And I clip my recordings and I watch those cutscenes with my wife so she can experience it. We can talk about it. And I look at her and go, why can't everything be written like that? Right. These just feel like real people. They feel like real women, having a real conversation. Like, this is just, it drives me up the wall that
I think what you
get paid to write shallow nothings.
I think what's hard is, and we've seen this in the MCU, like you see She-Hulk and you see a lot of the elements like this. I think you need female writers who don't have a chip on their shoulder. So someone who understands a female experience. So for example, back in 1985, there's an American cartoonist, Alison Bechdel, who wrote a cartoon about something that's, called the Bechdel test. And it's like, okay, are women being represented well in a film or a story? And the test is, are there two named female characters who talk about something other than another male character? And if you can't show that, it's like, maybe that's not really how women have other interests in their lives that make them interesting people. So you want to be able to satisfy the test, though, but without being going totally overboard in the other direction.
Yeah. Nope. Okay, well, I think my last Star Wars related question, and we'll see where this leads.
Yeah.
Would you consider Star Wars in the genre of fantasy or sci-fi?
It's very, very soft science fiction fantasy, I think is what I would put it as. Like one of the criticisms of J.J. Abrams, for example, so the difference here in science fiction, you have hard science fiction and soft science fiction. So hard science fiction is where you can explain the things that are going on here, and it's just applying science and extrapolations of it to fictional scenarios. So, for example, the book The Martian, which was made into a good film with Matt Damon. That would be an example of hard science fiction. I'm trying to remember the author, The Martian book. Andy Weir, W-E-I-R, Andy Weir. So there's clearly, Weir's done a ton of research. If an astronaut were stranded on an abandoned colony on Mars, how could he survive? What would he do? So you can tell a lot of thought has been gone into this scenario to explain what's going on here. Star Wars, how we get around the universe, how the lightsabers work. Well, it's a lot of, it's kyber crystals. It's this, it's the Force. There's not a lot of explanation. So is it scientifically possible? I'm not really sure. So it feels like a little bit like a space fantasy, a space opera. So I think that it still is within the boundaries of science fiction, but you would call it more like soft science fiction. So if you had a spectrum of hard to soft science fiction, Star Trek would be more towards the hard end than the soft end, though Star Trek is still pretty soft science fiction. Yeah, you mock Star Wars, well, it's kyber crystals that make this work. Well, how does this work in Star Trek? Well, we'll make up this ridiculous name for the cause, you know, this plasma orb drive, yada yada. Yeah. We need to do this. So Star Trek does a lot of jargon to get itself out of jams. Also, it's nowhere near hard science fiction either, but it's just a little bit more grounded than having space wizards.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've heard this, you know, seen this conversation on Twitter many a time, and I don't pay a lot of attention to it, but I think the best point in terms of Star Wars being fantasy is that it is at its core mythical, spiritual, right? Where you have the force that pervades everything, yeah. Right? This kind of being this force, this energy field, whatever it is, that's kind of like, you know, almost seemingly allows everything to like exist and, you know, bind together. That's just a very you know, mystical, fantastical element.
Yeah.
So that's why I would say, like, yeah, I would call it fantasy, because yeah, science fiction, I think you should be able to see like a development, like, okay, here's how we got there.
Right.
So there's a book trilogy. I forget the name of the trilogy. The first one's called Red Rising. It's kind of like a coming of age story. This guy, you know, this young boy who joins, what even is it? But you know, the Earth's military, or maybe it's the solar system military. There's a lot of political intrigue and stuff, but it's very much, you know, closer to hard science fiction, like you said, where you're like, okay, I see how we got here, and they've got the intergalactic travel, but they're still using these various technologies that are a couple steps above what we have now, but they're not lightsabers.
Yeah, or Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers, which is a lot different than the film with Casper Van Dien. But you're right. I guess if I had to call it Star Wars, yeah. I mean, science fiction, I'm really stretching it. I think more space fantasy or cosmic fantasy, because, I mean, think about the opening crawl. It says, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. I mean, that's really the same thing as saying once upon a time, which is the standard opening for fantasy. Yeah, in a faraway land. That's the standard opening for a fantasy story.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think that contributes to its timelessness, because sci-fi is only lasts as long as it's still in the future.
Right.
If you ask me. And, you know, granted, there's a lot of stuff. Like, we're not catching up to Star Trek anytime soon, or most sci-fi that's coming out anywhere close to recently. But, you know, fantasy having this mystical element to it. And again, especially with the hero's journey being a part of that, where it's like, okay, right. This is something that you can only really imagine, right? You can't see this happening in the real world. That's just not possible. But I think that kind of, it makes us wonder. Right. I think that's what fantasy does so well. It's that's what Lord of the Rings, you know, the ultimate fantasy novel does, is it
yes.
inspires us to wonder just at the sheer beauty of it. Every time that I pull open, like, I'm thinking of a passage from Lord of the Rings or something, a quote, and I pull open the Kindle app on my phone just to read the passage that I was thinking out to my wife, I end up reading like the next three paragraphs because the
totally.
So beautiful.
Yeah, you're drawn in.
I can't stop.
Yeah.
So I think we're about at an hour.
Yeah.
And those are all the questions I had. So any final thoughts that you have, Trent?
Nope, none at all. I think that it's always great to pursue truth, goodness, and beauty. As someone who explains and defends the Catholic faith, I always try to say, look, I mean, that which God made that is true, good, and beautiful, you can see it reflected in all kinds of things, even in the arts as well. They always point back to that kind of timeless wisdom from him. So it's always something good for people to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, that is kind of the mission of this channel, trying to just get people to think about, you know, how these stories change us, how they inspire us, make us, you know, better people, help us to love one another better. Ultimately, you know, that leads us to God. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
It's
here.
Great. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, sir. Same to you as well. And again, thank you so much for coming on. This was absolutely a blast. I had so much fun. Can't thank you enough.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for listening. Go check out Master Samwise's channel. And yeah, I just hope you have a very blessed weekend.